Hello everyone, I'm Keith Parent and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. India has vowed to bring one of its officials home at any price after her arrest in the United States as the diplomatic row escalates. The diplomat, Devinya Korabadid, has told the Indian media how she broke down in tears after being strip-searched. Her treatment has touched a raw nerve in India, a country that views itself as an emerging superpower. It has launched a number of reprisals against U.S. diplomats, including the return of identity cards for consular officials and removing security barricades outside the U.S. embassy. We have more from Michael Edwards.
India's television stations and newspapers are full of stories about the way Devyani Kobragada, an Indian diplomat stationed in New York, has been treated. The common theme is that it's outrageous and disrespectful behaviour by a supposed ally. These views are reflected among the public.
India should ban on that America activity. Whatever support we are giving to America, India should ban on that.
The row began when police stopped and arrested Ms. Kobragada on the street in New York last week. She's told the Indian media that she was handcuffed and then strip-searched, something now confirmed by the US Marshals Service. It's alleged she underpaid her maid, also an Indian national, and lied on a visa application. Under the Vienna Convention on Consular Relations, officials enjoy immunity from arrest only for crimes committed in connection with their work. India says the USA has violated these rules. Syed Akbaruddin is a spokesman for the Ministry of External Affairs.
We understand our obligations and our rights under the Vienna Conventions, and we will implement them fully and also ask for their implementation fully.
India's Foreign Minister Salman Khurshid has vowed to do whatever it takes to get the diplomat home. US consular officials have been asked for their diplomatic identity cards. And perhaps more alarmingly, security barricades have been removed from outside the embassy. One senior opposition politician even called for the arrest of American homosexuals living in India after a ruling last week that upheld a colonial-era ban on homosexuality. The situation has clearly caused huge offence in a country that sees itself as a rising world power.
This offends our middle-class sensitivities.
Professor Dipanka Gupta is a noted expert on Indian politics and society.
It doesn't affect all of India, but it does affect that section of India which is vocal, which counts in terms of their ability to influence policy decisions. And as with middle classes all over the world, the Indian middle class too is very nationalistic in character.
Having full-time household help is a given for most middle-class Indians. Ms. Kobragada is alleged to have told US authorities that she would pay her maid around $4,000 a month, the US minimum wage. Officials say she was paying her $600 a month, a wage Dipanka Gupta says Indians would consider fair and even generous.
You don't like the way in which she pays her servants? Fine, you'd ask her to leave the country. And that is something that, you know, is the most you can do. You can't strip search and put somebody in jail. In that case, we should do the same thing as well over here when they break our laws.
Ms. Kobragada has been released on bail after giving up her passport and pleading not guilty to the charges. She faces a maximum of 15 years in jail if convicted on both counts.
It's been 2 years since the death of Kim Jong-il, and the late North Korean son and successor, Kim Jong-un, is still stamping his authority on the country. The young North Korean leader last week executed his uncle, Jang Suk-tak. Once considered North Korea's second most powerful man, the Pyongyang state media has now moved to erase all references to him on online reports. And after last week's execution, South Korea's military is back on high alert. Adam Connors has the story.
The young leader of North Korea's massive standing army is moving quickly to stamp his authority on the military, following the dramatic purge and execution of his uncle last week. North Korean soldiers held a mass rally in Pyongyang to swear an oath of loyalty to Kim Jong-un on Monday. North Asian leaders are increasingly concerned about the consequences of Friday's execution of Jang Suk-tak, considered the second most powerful man in North Korea.
When we look at the recent developments in North Korea, it's uncertain in what direction the situation will go. We can't rule out any unexpected scenarios, such as reckless provocations.
The US Secretary of State says the execution shows an unstable and dangerous state.
Most importantly, it underscores the importance for all of us of finding a way forward with North Korea in order to denuclearize the peninsula.
But China continues to take a considered approach.
We're making further observations of the domestic and foreign policies of North Korea. We hope and we believe there should be no major changes.
The timing of the instability is uncomfortable, with the anniversary of Kim Jong-il's death on Tuesday and more large gatherings, along with tensions over the East and South China Seas. Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe has been courting his Southeast Asian neighbours on China's air defence identification zones. Vietnamese Prime Minister Win Tan Dung was among leaders from Cambodia and Thailand to discuss the issue at the weekend's ASEAN summit in Tokyo.
China should take seriously the fact that many nations are concerned about their new air defence identification zone.
The final Southeast Asian Nations Summit statement agreed on the need for freedom of the high seas and skies and called for the peaceful resolution of disputes.
Despite laws banning child marriage in India, it is still widely practiced as authorities continue to turn a blind eye to early marriages. Campaigners say the prevailing problem of child marriage is responsible for the poor health and childbirth records in the country. For more, here's Murali Krishnan.
In the western reach of India's most heavily touristed state, Rajasthan, the deep-rooted custom of child marriages is widely prevalent. Figures indicate that every fourth girl in the rural hinterland is getting married before attaining the age of 18. UNICEF paints a more worrisome picture. 15% of girls in rural areas across the country are married before 13, and over 50% of girls have their first pregnancy between 15 and 19. Krina Shah, a campaigner for child rights, explains the implication.
It is serious. Serious enough to look at as not limited to the woman's right perspective, but from the point of view of child protection. Girls and boys, both are being affected. Rural and urban, both areas are being affected. Increasingly, number of boys are getting married at a younger age. So it is pan-India problem, which actually has a base in child protection.
Unusual rituals in Rajasthan persist, and that makes it difficult to change the outlook of the people. The Masoor ceremony is one such tradition of forced marriage. Upon the death of a family member, a marriage must be solemnized in the family within 13 days in order to convert the occasion of sorrow into one of joy, even if the family members are not of marriageable age. It's a closed-door affair, and the media is certainly not welcome. Rights campaigners say child marriages triggers a series of infringements that continues throughout a girl's life. It starts with forced initiation into sex and ongoing sexual violence, resulting in early and unplanned pregnancy. This, they say, puts her life or that of her child's at risk. Razia Ismail is from the Indian Alliance for Child Rights.
I see it as a chronic and continuingly very serious problem. The state does not seem to be confident to move to ban it. It's like child labor. You want to discourage it, you make it illegal, you do various things, but you don't actually abolish it. And the same obtains for child marriage.
But there are pockets in the country which have been waging a campaign against the traditional practice of child marriage. At a counseling center for underprivileged children, young girls are being sensitized. Shaheen, a worker, is telling children of the risk confronting young brides.
The family mistakenly perceive that it is a secure thing to marry a girl at a younger age so that she can easily be able to socialize in a different family, and also it is a security of a girl seeing the circumstances in unsafe environment, also the financial crunches at home, also the pressure from the society.
Some of the girls in their early teens have wisened up to the loss of childhood. Afsana is a 15-year-old girl. I know child marriage is rampant because some families perceive having too many children as an economic burden. That is bad. Her colleague Nazmi is also shocked. It is unfortunate that a girl is denied the chance to lead a full life. And after marriage, both the boy and girl can have health problems and they don't know how to deal with the situation. Though there are other countries like Niger, the Central African Republic, and Malawi, which rank among the highest rates of child marriage, in terms of absolute numbers and because of the size of its population, India has the most. Studies show that India has the largest number of child brides in the world, with 47% girls married under the legal age of 18. Ms. Ismail again.
You find that children are not allowed to develop as people. They're already put into roles which are socially sanctioned, rather than roles which would be perhaps their natural choice. And this is too early. This is too early in the formation of your life for you to be forced into a social role in which you are actually put into an adult service function, both sexually and socially.
India still has a long way to go in stopping child marriages. But for many young girls, it still continues to be a harsh reality.
And if you've just tuned in, you're listening to PCJ Radio International. The name of the program is Focus Asia Pacific. Stay tuned. We have more right after this. Australia-Indonesian relations have been through a difficult patch, and they say they could become strained again, with the imminent Australian lawyers demanding authorities in Jakarta investigate allegations of a massacre 15 years ago in West Papua. Now, a former Australian director of public prosecutions is leading the charge to have an inquiry opened in Indonesia. There's already been the Citizens Tribunal into the incident in which Australia, where witnesses claim more than 100 people were killed, raped, and tortured. Matt Peacock reports.
On the picturesque Biak Island in Indonesia's West Papua, 15 years ago, families of the mainly Christian population held a rare protest. 17 and still at school, Yuda Korwa joined it.
My friends told me that they're raising the Morning Star, West Papua Morning Star, and then say, oh, okay, come on then, we go in and see what's happening there.
For 4 days, the flag flew as protesters sang Christian hymns. Then at dawn, July 6, the Indonesian army, navy and police attacked.
I saw so many people have been killed with the military. I saw the little boy killed and the old people, the pregnant woman and then little girl.
Basically, as everyone was singing, the troops started shooting into the crowd, and in those initial moments, people were mowed down.
Anthropologist Eben Kirksey was a young American undergraduate then passing through Biak.
The people who survived were herded down to the harbor, and as they were being prepared to be put on these ships, they could see back that the dead and the dying from that initial assault were being loaded into trucks.
His skull cracked and stabbed, Yuda Korwa was one of the few to escape alive. He limped away and hid for 2 days in a road culvert. But there was worse to follow.
After they were forced onto the boats, one woman who survived that, who jumped off when the boat was near shore, people were being raped and tortured from the very moment they got on board.
It's estimated more than 150 bodies were dumped at sea. Indonesia has never admitted the massacre, claiming only one person was killed and blaming the bodies that washed ashore on a subsequent tsunami. The action was strongly supported by the then head of Indonesia's military, General Wiranto.
Wiranto, on the day after the attack, on July 7th, he's saying in the media that these people were traitors. He's saying that if they were raising a flag, that was a crime enough to justify what was done to them. So Wiranto clearly knew about the attack, and the police and military were also involved in the cover-up.
Earlier this year at Sydney University, a citizens' tribunal took evidence of what really happened at Biak 15 years ago.
We're going to use this to cut off your vaginas from above and below and from the left and to the right.
Testifying here for the first time, Tiniki Rumakabu saw her friend beheaded. She herself was tortured horribly.
She was raped. She was treated in the most degrading and vicious fashion by Indonesian police.
The former New South Wales Crown Prosecutor, Nicholas Cowdery, was the counsel assisting the Citizens Tribunal.
There are investigations that can now be conducted by an independent judicial body of some kind in Indonesia. There is the opportunity for perhaps some kind of special prosecutor to conduct investigations and proceedings in Indonesia. There is the opportunity for the Indonesians to provide compensation to the families who suffered loss or injury.
Indonesia has refused to comment on the Citizens Tribunal, which has also called on Australia to take action.
The Australian government has a duty to these people that died and their families who still live on to expose what happened, to stop it happening again.
Yuda Korwa, who with his nephew survived a perilous escape to Australia, has been granted political asylum. Now living in Canberra, he hopes his new country will support his people.
Australian government, they have to stand up and then they have to investigate again what happened since 6th of July 1998.
An Australian parliamentary delegation left for Solomon Islands and Nauru this week. The group, led by Foreign Minister Julie Bishop, includes Parliamentary Secretary for Foreign Affairs Brett Mason, the opposition Foreign Affairs spokesman Tanya Pilbersek, her colleague Matt Thistlethwaite, and the Australian Ambassador for Women and Girls, Natasha Solop-Desporgia. The trip comes as the Abbott government announces massive cuts in aid spending and the mid-year budget update showing Australia is facing a massive deficit. Campbell Cooney reports.
While the past few weeks in Australia's parliament have been heated, the leader of the delegation, Foreign Minister Julie Bishop, says all four MPs taking part are working together.
We get along very well. We have common interests in the Pacific. We all want to see the Pacific flourish and thrive. And so when you have a common interest, then differences can be set aside.
Tanya Plibersek is the opposition's foreign affairs spokesperson.
We've got plenty to argue about back in Australia. On a trip like this, I think most of the issues are bipartisan. The interest in aid and development, improving education, health services and so on, that's something that's of interest to all Australians, and there's a great deal of bipartisanship on that.
Travelling with the MPs is Australia's newly appointed Ambassador for Women and Girls, Natasha Stott-Despoja, herself a former leader of the Australian Democrats. It's an appointment Ms. Plibersek supports unreservedly.
Natasha's made a very strong mark in women's issues in Australia, and I'm sure she'll do the same globally.
As well as meeting the leaders and MPs of the countries on the trip's itinerary, it also provides an opportunity to announce new projects funded by Australia. Yesterday it was initiatives in Solomon Islands.
I announced $15 million over 5 years to a Pacific Business Fund. I announced that Australia will dedicate $500,000 over 2 years to open up economic opportunity for women. And I made a significant announcement regarding domestic violence and preventing family violence. $5 million for a program to help prevent incidents of family and domestic violence in Solomon Islands.
Today the group flies to Nauru for the day, then on to Vanuatu, with announcements scheduled in both countries. But Nauru is also the location of one of Australia's offshore asylum seeker detention and processing centres, reopened by the previous Labor government, and which, according to the new coalition government, are set to be expanded even further. Tanya Plibersek's confirmed a visit to the Nauru centre will be part of their stop.
Certainly seeing the processing centre is something that's high on my list of priorities.
The trip comes just months after the election of the new Australian government, which announced in the days before it was elected that it was making massive cuts to Australia's aid budget, with aid priorities to be placed in line with the country's trade and business priorities. Foreign Minister Julie Bishop wants to assure Pacific nations that doesn't mean their needs will be ignored.
Our aid program will continue to support Australia's foreign and trade policy priorities, which includes a safe and secure and prosperous Pacific region. About 19 or 20% of all Australia's official development assistance is provided to the Pacific. So we will continue to be a major player in international development assistance in the Pacific region.
Ms. Plibersek's not so sure.
If you're talking about Solomon Islands, even things like 140,000 young Solomon Islanders get an education now because Australian aid money has helped get rid of school fees. 86% of women now deliver their baby with a skilled birth attendant because we've boosted the health system. These are very real effects, and of course they are endangered when you see cuts of the scale that this government proposed.
The bipartisan Pacific trip is happening at the same time that Australia's Treasurer Joe Hockey has released the mid-year budget update, forecasting a deficit of up to $47 billion this year with economic growth to remain weak, leading to concerns that more cuts to aid spending are on the table. Mr. Hockey and his government have laid the blame for the poor forecasts at the feet of the previous Labor government.
I saw a bit of Joe Hockey on TV and it looked like a whole string of excuses for why he's not responsible for the nation's budget. He said before the election, if debt was the problem, then more debt's not the answer. Well, I think what we saw from him there is another one of those nasty surprises that we've become so used to.
And finally on the program, at one time, Singapore had a vibrant film industry. We're talking about in the 1950s and early 1960s, when major Asian production houses like the Shaw Brothers and Cathay Kidders would often shoot on the island state. Well, half a century later, Singapore may once again find its place on the international stage. Well, recently, at the 2013 Asia-Pacific Screen Awards, which were held in Brisbane, Australia, there was one film that did come out on top. It stars the best actor who won the award, who was a South Korean actor by the name of Lee Bong-hwan, and Hong Kong actress Zhang Zai. She won for Best Actress. But the director's award was taken out by Singapore's Anthony Chen for this film, Lolo, which is about a boy and his Filipina maid. After the awards were held, Robert McLean caught up with Anthony Chen to talk about this.
I'm really surprised. I'm completely surprised. You know, I wasn't expecting to get anything, really. So it's been amazing because, you know, it's such a talented pool of nominees, you know, amongst them a director that I really, really respect a lot as well, Hirokazu Koreeda from Japan. So it's such an incredible honor.
It's not the first award you've had for the film. How many awards have you won now?
I think this is the 22nd or the 23rd. I can't remember.
Is the film up for an Oscar nomination early in the new year? And if so, in which category?
The film is Singapore's official submission for the foreign language Oscar. But, you know, whether it gets a nomination, you know, nobody knows. We'll see. Fingers crossed on that.
Are you more confident of success at the Oscars following tonight's win?
I'm not going to, you know, pin too high a hope, because Singapore has been submitting films for the past several years. We have never earned any nomination before. So, you know, for me, if it does get a nomination, you know, great. Great for the film, and I'll be really, really happy. But I'm not going to be disappointed because, yeah, I just think it feels so unachievable.
What is the film about?
The film is a family portrait set in 1997 during the Asian financial crisis in Singapore. It focuses on the relationship of 10-year-old boy and his Filipino nanny. I would say that it's inspired by a lot of childhood memories. I wouldn't say that it's completely autobiographical, but a lot of emotions, you know, and moments were literally from those years of growing up in the 90s in Singapore.
What prompted you to make a film about that experience?
It really started, I think, a few years ago, 3 years ago, when I wanted to make my first feature film. And, you know, all these childhood memories came flooding back into my head. And I remember one moment when I was 12 and I was in the airport and she was going to leave to go home to the Philippines. She has been in our household for 8 years. And I remember I just cried and cried and cried. And, yeah, it was really painful. And it really started from there, that one piece of emotion. I was trying to understand what this relationship is. I was trying to make sense of all of this.
How would you describe your relationship with the maid when you were growing up?
I would say she's both a friend, you know, a servant, you know, almost like a surrogate mother. She cares for us, she dotes on us, but at the same time, she disciplines us. I would say, you know, during that time, it was akin to having another family member.
I understand you recently caught up with her in the Philippines after Typhoon Haiyan. Describe that for me.
I actually met her again after 16 years because of this film as well. After this film, won a prize in Cannes. The Filipino media wanted to find out who she is, and we had lost complete contact until they managed to find her. So it was, you know, it was really moving. It was very surreal, very, very emotional, I would say. And I'm really glad that, because Iloilo, where she's from, it was hit by the typhoon as well, and I was so worried that, because she lives in a wooden, literally a wooden hut. I've been there. And I was so glad that, you know, it wasn't blown away and everything is fine. She, her partner, her entire village is fine. Yeah, I'm very, very thankful for that.
And how many countries is the film screening in at the moment?
The film has screened in Singapore and Hong Kong and Taiwan and Thailand. It opened in France and Switzerland. We've just opened in the Philippines. Next year, we're opening in Korea and Sweden and UK and US and Australia coming up middle of next year, I think. So it's been sold to over 20 countries. So it's been a very, very special year, because it's very rare that a Singapore film actually gets its chance to make its mark in the world.
Is your award for Best Director at the Asia Pacific's Screen Awards, is that a boost for the Singaporean film industry?
I would say that the film has been on a real run, on a real roll for quite a couple of months. And, you know, this is definitely an immense recognition. It's a great honor because, you know, the film was contending amongst, you know, very respectable and very, very highly qualified nominees. So I think it says something about the maturity of Singapore cinema, that we are sort of turning the corner, we are turning a new chapter. The response has been generally very positive. I was actually quite surprised how universal the film is, given that it's very culturally specific, it's very set in a local context. I've been actually quite surprised by how moved people are by this film.
Anthony Chen, the Singapore director of the film Lolo, which won two awards at the 2013 Asia Pacific Screening Celebrations in Brisbane. And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific. If you want to contact us, our email address is very simple. It's focus@pcjmedia.com. On behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Powell, wishing you well. We'll see you again in 7 days' time. Goodbye, everyone.